As some of you know, we have had one discussion on the political theory of the Constitution. We're very privileged that Russell Kirk would be with us for the second. Professor Robert Morgan, who will be the third in the series, will speak on November the 1st. It has seemed to us this was a fundamental area of concern and sometimes neglected in the discussions, the bicentennial discussions of the Constitution. Russell Kirk really needs no introduction. I think the best introduction, really, is just to remind you of some of his writings and to refresh your memory that he is a Michigander, born in Plymouth, got his bachelor's degree at Michigan State, a master's degree from Duke, and is a doctor of letters from St. Andrews University, Scotland. Has numerous honorary degrees, has taught here and abroad at many institutions, is the founder of the quarterly journal Modern Age, and the editor of the quarterly University Bookman. But it is in his writings that he gives us a legacy that will be a priceless treasure for years to come. Just to read a few of the titles is to point to this contribution. The Conservative Mind, A Program for Conservatives in This Area, John Randolph of Roanoke, Academic Freedom, The American Cause, Old House of Fears, Confessions of a Bohemian Tory, The Intemperate Professor, Edmund Burke, and recently Edmund Burke Revisited, Political Principles of Robert Taft, Eliot and His Age, Enemies of the Permanent Things, Roots of the American Order, Lord of the Hollow Dark, Conservative Reader, and so on. So not only with reference to the Constitution, but for political theory in general, Russell Kirk has made an enduring contribution to our understanding of political thought. I'm delighted you're with us, Professor Kirk.
Thank you, Dr. Kessler. It's very good to be here with you all. And back at the University of Virginia, where I've spoken from time to time over the years, and to talk about with you about this large topic which you assigned me on the political theory of the Constitution. So I propose to make some desultory remarks for half an hour or a little more, and look forward to your questions and observations. Now, despite all the activity in the bicentenary of the Constitution, this very large topic has been somewhat neglected and I think much misunderstood what theories lie behind the frame of the Constitution. The Constitution that was drawn up in 1787 was the product of experience, primarily, not of theory. That's why, as a principal reason why it has endured. Nevertheless, certain men of intellect, not present at Philadelphia, and indeed not friendly toward makers of constitutions and revolutions, helped to shape that constitution. And so I propose to talk really briefly about three such: Edmund Burke, David Hume, and William Blackstone, and how they helped frame the Constitution. Constitutions are something more than lines written upon parchment. When a written constitution endures, and most of them don't endure very long, that document has been derived successfully from long-established customs, beliefs, statutes, and interests. It has reflected a political order already accepted, tacitly at least, by the dominant element among the people. True constitutions, in short, are not invented, they grow. The Constitution of the United States has endured for two centuries because it arose from the healthy roots of more than a century of colonial experience and several centuries of British experience. For the most part, the Constitution of 1787 expressed formally what was already accepted, practiced, and believed in by for the people of the new republic. A constitution without deep roots is no true constitution at all. It doesn't endure. Sometimes the Constitution of 1787 is praised as if it had been created out of whole cloth overnight from the glowing imagination of the framers. But that notion is far from the truth. Sometimes the framers themselves are spoken of with a veneration like that accorded to the Hebrew prophets or the mythical founders of Greek cities. But actually, the Constitution, for the most part, grew out of a long practical political usage and compromise rather than springing from ingenious, fine-spun theories of an innovating character. As Daniel Boorstin, the ablest of our present American historians, has written in several of his books, the genius of American politics consists in the American habit of refraining from abstract doctrine and theoretic dogma. Now, this notwithstanding, of course, ideas well expressed by writers of intellectual authority did influence the 55 framers at Philadelphia and did contribute to the shaping of our constitutional structure. It's some importance, to distinguish these ideas and to ascribe them correctly to certain sources. For decades, the typical American school textbook in history has asserted that the great name of John Locke commanded the minds of both the signers of the Declaration of Independence and of the framers of the Constitution. But nowadays, many of us have become aware of how wretched a production is a typical school textbook. A good many names of dead authors, some of them political philosophers, appear in the pages of the Federalist. The essays that were intended to induce the New Yorkers to ratify the Constitution. And yet the name of Locke does not appear, such to be found in Madison's notes of debates in the Federal Convention. Does not the hard fact of such omissions from the Federalist and from Madison's notes seem significant to the writers and editors of textbooks? In truth, Locke did not fix American political convictions in the 18th century or the 19th. Locke was merely one of a number of important political thinkers who contributed to the climate of political opinion about the time the Constitution was written. And in fact, the ascribing of so much influence to Locke is largely the work of Vernon Parrington and Charles Beard earlier this century, and they had reasons for ascribing things to Locke, but it's not historically supported if you really know the reading, say, in the expressions of the framers of the Constitution. Locke was merely one of many authors they had read had some influence upon them. In most matters, after all, Locke was no original thinker, but rather a synthesizer or popularizer. In moral philosophy, he endeavored to harmonize the findings of 17th century science with Christian doctrine. Similarly, in politics, he sought to work the opinions of earlier philosophers into a system consonant with the historical experience and the new needs of England near the end of the 17th century. Society is a product of a voluntary contract among men equal in the state of nature, writes Locke in his Civil Government. To secure the better the rights that are theirs by nature, life, liberty, and estate or real property. Locke has much more to say about estate than he has to say about life and liberty. Several times he declares that, in his words, the reason why men enter into society is the preservation of their property. This argument appeals strongly to colonial Americans, a high proportion of whom own some sort of real property. But can Locke's ideal of the social compact be taken seriously in the 20th century? Indeed, was it taken seriously by the framers in 1787? Certainly, they did not mention anything of the sort. Marx's contract theory is one of several postulates that he fails to establish satisfactorily. Only 60 years after his Civil Government was published, David Hume would make mincemeat of Locke's theory that men at any remote period ever joined themselves into a formal compact for their common welfare. The historical origins of the state, Hume would point out, are nothing like Locke's imaginary primitive voluntary union. Instead, force and conquest, in England as elsewhere, have occurred recently or in some remote period, and have resulted in the formation of a state, although afterward, most states are held together by interest and by sentiment as well. So too Edmund Burke, in addition to Hume, so Burke implied, although he, like Locke, was a Whig. Well, nearly a century after Locke, Burke advised his generation to, in Burke's words, to draw a sacred veil over the remote origins of the state. Perhaps Locke's law of nature is not applicable to natural primitive man, but rather to civilized Englishmen, whose impulses and appetites have been chastened by Christian teaching. Now, 100 years after Locke, Burke found it necessary to oppose the French Revolution on the very grounds that Locke had employed to justify the Glorious Revolution of 1688. But Burke did not turn to the so-called law of nature in Locke's sense of that phrase. Instead, Burke affirmed the richer natural law tradition of Hooker, the schoolmen of the 14th century, and Cicero. Burke appealed back beyond Locke to an idea of community far warmer and richer than Locke's or Hobbes's aggregation of individuals. The true compact of society, Burke told his countrymen, is eternal. It joins the dead, the living, and the unborn. We all participate in this spiritual and social partnership because this partnership is ordained of God. In defense of social harmony, Burke appealed to what Locke had ignored, the love of neighbor and the sense of duty. By the time of the French Revolution, Locke's argument in his second treatise already had become insufficient to sustain a social order. Now, some such misgivings about Locke's first principles may be discerned among men of the revolutionary and constitutional era in North America. That is, among those thoughtful Americans who had read Locke carefully rather than receiving his concepts at second or third hand. It is worth noting that Locke's civil government was not printed in America until 1773, no American edition until then. By 1776, and still more by 1787, John Locke's books were dusty enough for Americans. Well, then let me turn to the second part of my argument here. At bottom, the thinking Americans of the last quarter of the 18th century found their principles of order in no single political philosopher, but rather in their religion. In the King James Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, for many, and the Pilgrim's Progress. With Patrick Henry, they were guided by the lamp of experience, that is, usage and precedent of the colonies and of Britain. And when schooled Americans of that era approved an author, commonly it was because his books confirmed their American experience and justified convictions they held already. So far as Locke served their needs, they employed Locke. But other men of ideas served them more immediately. In any age, including our own, the rising generation is influenced mainly by important books published during their own formative years. Those books are read in youth, as we would say in the college years. A generation later, the opinions expressed in those books may be reflected in the actions of leading men and women who studied them when, but hardly more than children, they were seeking for guidance. It was so with the thought of Montesquieu, Hume, Blackstone, and Burke especially. At the Constitutional Convention, no man was quoted more frequently than Montesquieu. The English translation of the Spirit of Laws had been published in 1750, That is, when the delegates to the Great Convention were small boys. Montesquieu rejects Hobbes's compact formed out of fear. But also, if less explicitly, Montesquieu rejects Locke's version of the social compact. Actually, Montesquieu disagrees with Locke more often than he agrees. He learned at least as much, and probably a good deal more, from the Tory Bolingbroke, with whom he was personally acquainted. From Montesquieu, rather than from Locke, the framers obtained a theory of checks and balances and of the division of powers. But Montesquieu's powerful influence upon the framers is so generally recognized today that we need not labor the point. Let us turn then to the Tory, Hume. There was at least a Scottish Tory, which is somewhat different in those days from being an English Tory. David Hume, called by Samuel Johnson a Tory by chance, was the most influential historian read by the framers. And Burke's, and rather Hume's, interpretation of English history prevailed in America, despite Jefferson's endeavor to bring out a Boulderized edition of Hume, in which all the Tory opinions would be changed to Whig opinions. Jefferson didn't succeed in getting that published in America. It was the amusement of Hume, that amiable skeptic, to puncture balloons. The biggest balloon that came his way was John Locke, whom Hume thoroughly undid in his Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding, published in 1748. Reason of a capital R, pure rationality as a guide to morals and politics, dominated the first half of the 18th century, and Locke was the grand champion of the system, although others carried that rationalistic system to extremes. Pure reason never recovered from Hume's rapier thrust in the middle of the century, and the framers, most of them, sought for a better guide than abstract reason in questions of law. Intellectually, then, Hume undid the compact theory in his treatise and his Morals. The American Constitution would not be framed on the compact theory of Locke, and certainly not that of Rousseau, for Hume had undone the notion of a primitive social compact. Even among the states of 18th century Europe, after centuries of civilization, so Hume inquires, how many governments in Hume's day might be said to rest upon the consent of the governed, and so to require no domestic garrisons? And Hume replies, only the United Kingdom, the Dutch Republic, and some of the Swiss cantons. Only those states were concerned with the consent of the governed. It didn't require garrisons in their principal towns. So says Hume, the consent of the governed is the unusual thing in politics, not the standard thing. Nations are not so governed ordinarily by the consent of the governed. And of course they aren't today. They're governed by oligarchies or tyrants, most of the world today, usually ideological oligarchs. And so says Hume, why indulge the idyllic fancies of Locke? Among Hume's more important American admirers were Hamilton and Madison. As Irving Brant, through Madison, something of Hume went directly into the Constitution. As Irving Brant notes in his Life of Madison, I quote Brant directly here, from David Hume, who saw that social conflicts were infinitely more complex than Aristotle thought them to be, came the idea that stability could be attained by balancing class against class, interest against interest. Wherefore, a large republic should be more stable than a small one, though harder to organize. He correctly attributes that influence of Hume as to forming Madison's ideas on that topic. What Madison and other framers found convincing in Hume was his freedom from mystification, vulgar error, and fanatic conviction. Hume's powerful practical intellect, which settled for politics as the art of the possible. Although so mordant a critic of abstract reason, David Hume was conspicuously rational. He shunned the narrow zealot in politics, and so did the framers of the Constitution. So they cited him, Hume, in their debates, and they did not cite Locke. Well, I'm up to my third point here. Sir William Blackstone, too. Like was like Hume, Atari was in the minds of the framers. His commentaries on the laws of England, published in 1765, the year of the Stamp Act, were sold in the 13 colonies so widely that their total North American sale nearly equaled their sale in Britain, despite the disparity in population. And Blackstone's account of English law, there is something of Locke and something of Montesquieu, but chiefly the inheritance of common law and equity. Especially in America, the commentaries serve the useful purpose of making it possible, in the phrase of Blackstone, for the gentleman and the scholar, as well as the lawyer, to discern order in the tremendous mass of precedents accumulated over seven centuries. Despite Blackstone's own confusion as to the sources of natural law, clearly Blackstone teaches that good order results from precedent and prescription, which Burke called the chartered rights of Englishmen. Blackstone did declare three what he called absolute rights, the natural liberty of mankind consisting of three articles, the right of personal security, the right of personal liberty, and the right to private property, in Blackstone's own phrase. Yet these rights were not absolute in the sense of having no limits. As Blackstone wrote, that every man, when he enters into society, I'll put him here directly, every man obliges himself to conform to these laws which the community has thought proper to establish. In that sentence, more than in Locke's phrases, may be found a fundamental doctrine of American politics. The men of the convention had read their Blackstone more attentively than their Locke, both because Blackstone was a contemporary of some of them, and because the livelihood of many of them, more than half the delegates being lawyers or judges, or having been such, depended in large part upon their apprehending Blackstone. Well, then is my fourth point, that when we come to the man whose connections with America were far more direct than those of Hume or Blackstone, Edmund Burke. While Burke in the House of Commons was the most formidable opponent of George III and Lord North, and for some years was agent at Westminster for the province of New York, while that went on, Burke was read attentively by all Americans interested in politics. Burke's account of the Revolution, published in the Annual Register during the Revolutionary Years, which periodical Burke himself, with his staff, edited, Burke's account in the Annual Register became America's accepted account of the revolutionary struggle, in part through the large plagiarisms of John Marshall and other early historians. See, Marshall took whole long passages out, transferred them verbatim from the Annual Register to his life of George Washington. Marshall, after all, was out there as a colonel fighting and getting wounded, and to get a large view of what the revolution was all about, he read the Annual Register, Burke. Appeal, though he might, to the old Whigs, Burke was no pupil of Locke. He set himself against Locke's notion of the social compact, inherited by Rousseau, and against Locke's psychology. Now, Burke never wrote or said anything about the Constitution drawn up at Philadelphia in 1787, much though he commented upon the British Constitution and upon the several French constitutions of his time. He wrote nothing at all about the American Constitution. Nor is Burke's name to be found in the recorded proceedings of the convention at Philadelphia. Neither is it mentioned in the pages of the Federalist. After the year 1782 and American independence, Burke scarcely mentions North American affairs in his speeches, correspondence, his publications. Then why assert that this great Whig politician, who never visited the United 13 colonies, somehow may be associated with that highly successful political device, the Constitution of the United States? Well, I have my reasons. First, because the general frame and substance of the Constitution of 1787 accords with the political principles of the Rockingham Whigs, whose manager and intellectual chief Burke was. The framers borrowed deliberately and literally from the British Constitution. according to Sir Henry Maine, in his book Popular Government, the American framers took for their model the English Constitution as it stood between the years 1760 and 1787, the years when Burke loomed so large in the House of Commons and spoke so much on constitutional theory and practice. Now, I don't suggest that everything in the Constitution of 1787 would have been thoroughly approved by Burke. Yet, for the most part, the Constitution was not only derived from the 18th century British Constitution, but was modeled more precisely upon that idea of the British Constitution, which Burke himself had enunciated so ringingly from his Thoughts on the Present Discontents, published in 1770, to his speech on moving resolutions for conciliation of the colonies, delivered in 1775. In substance, the Constitution of the United States was an amended version of what Burke called the Chartered Rights of Englishmen. Burke had been the principal expositor of the British Constitution that the American gentlemen at Philadelphia took for their general model. And Burke, like those American gentlemen, was a practical public man of much experience, no closet philosopher, and so was congenial to the framers, whether or not they acknowledged Burke as the British Constitution's soundest interpreter, whether or not, indeed, they were aware of Burke's influence upon them. The delegates to Philadelphia, naturally enough, apprehended the English Constitution very much as the great Whig Burke had expounded in their own time. Also the framers, youngish men, many of them, only eight having been signers of the Declaration of Independence, the framers had grown up during the decade when the parliamentary addresses of Burke and Chatham had upheld the cause of the colonies against the Crown and Parliament. When Burke's Irish invective had been directed against George III's American policies, his ministers, and indeed against the king himself. Burke's famous American speeches had been read and discussed by every American of the rising generation who had taken any interest in politics. Moreover, Burke exercised, through the serious journalism of the Annual Register, an ascendancy over the minds of leading Americans of the Revolutionary and Constitutional eras, an influence greater than is obtained over the American people two centuries later by the most famous publicist of our day. The delegates to the Great Convention were steeped in Burke whether they wished it or no. In short, Burke had virtually a monopoly of serious commentary from abroad on the course of the Revolution and its significance through the pages of the Annual Register, the only widely distributed serious publication of history and politics at the time, of a permanent character. Burke had weight with such of the framers, particularly, as Alexander Hamilton, Governor Morris, Benjamin Franklin, who was personally acquainted with Burke, George Washington, James Iredell, and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. Some of the delegates, notably James Wilson, later would disagree in theory with Burke on large matters. But in 1787, when Thomas Paine still thought of Burke as a friend to revolutionary change, in 1787, those differences with Wilson and other Democrats were not yet conspicuous. Why then is Burke's name absent from Madison's Notes of Debates? Why did not the authors of the Federalist cite Burke? Why, because the delegates at Philadelphia were too much occupied with practical disputation to quote from statists abroad. They do not mention either, so far as reports of their debates go, the other two chief constitutional thinkers of the closing decades of the 18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Jeremy Bentham. They don't mention them at all. Nor, for that matter, did they even mention Blackstone, even though they'd all read him. Both the men of the convention and the authors of the Federalist mentioned Montesquieu several times. Mentioned Hume, Renan, Delaune, and one or two other 18th century writers, pretty thoroughly forgotten nowadays. But the literary, historical, and philosophical allusions of Madison, Hamilton, and Jay are drawn chiefly from antiquity. Gentlemen benefiting from a classical education, the authors of the Federalist turned naturally to familiar Greek and Latin writers whose authority would be recognized by many readers of the Federalist Papers. Now, Burke, on the other hand, in 1787, was partisan and quick, a British party leader passionately committed to a reforming course in English politics. What Burke might do next, as a rather excitable Irishman in 1787, well, they didn't know what he might do next. His indictment of Warren Hastings was of small immediate interest to the delegates at Philadelphia, even though Burke's disquisitions on the rule of law in the course of Hastings' indictment and prosecution had much to do with political institutions. Burke's enduring reputation was yet to be determined in 1787. It was more prudent in America to cite, among recent writers, David Hume. Hume having died in 1776, Hume could not demur from what might be said about him at the convention. Well, Burke might have denounced the convention, for all I knew. If I quote Burke at a convention which he might be tempted to reproach, it was sufficiently clear that Burke had not approved the Declaration of Independence. Thus, Burke's understanding of constitutions went formally unacknowledged to Philadelphia. Nevertheless, Burke's constitutionalism was pervasive there. 3 years later, when reflections on the revolution in France would appear, Burke's arguments and aphorisms would be on the lips of every American politically literate, mostly favorable comments, some unfavorable. It was otherwise in 1787. Nevertheless, the delegates of 1787 produced a constitution that conformed astonishingly to Burke's idea of what a good constitution must be, with, of course, the large exception of the lack of the cabinet structure like that of the British that was wholly missing in America. As Sir William Holdsworth puts it, this in his History of English Law, in Holdsworth's words, the political theory of the Declaration of Independence, which dwells upon the equality of men, their inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and their right to resist a tyrannical government, retired into the background, that is, in 1787. The founders of the American Constitution recognized with Burke that such theories, however well they might be suited to a period of revolution, were of very little help in a period of Reconstruction. They therefore abandoned the democratic theories of Paine and Rousseau and went for inspiration to the 18th century British Constitution with which they were familiar. I'm into that. As Carl Becker reminds us, the Declaration of Independence was written in language pleasing to the French court and the French philosophes, out of the desperate need of the Continental Congress for French aid. But the Constitution of the United States was written in the language of British constitutional order, of Montesquieu and of Hume and Blackstone and Burke, for good order was the necessity of the year 1787. In these bicentennial years, I think we'd do well to renew our knowledge of the constitutional wisdom of Burke in particular, as well as the wisdom of the authors of the Federalist. Burke's unfinished fourth letter on a regicide peace, his last published work, terminates with the fragment of a sentence, which runs as follows. There's no such euthanasia for the British Constitution. There his sentence ends, that's the last word he ever wrote, euthanasia of the Constitution. Here Burke refers to an early essay by Hume, in which the speculative Scot suggested that in the fullness of time, the decaying British Constitution might die an easy death from inanition, a case of euthanasia, in Hume's words, gently expiring without a groan in the paternal arms of a mere monarchy. The end of the Constitution would not be painless, Burke declared, not if Jacobin France or Jacobins within Britain should gain the mastery. The end would be terrible, said Burke, a destruction of Britain's civil social order by merciless finance. Well, neither would there, I think, be any euthanasia for the Constitution of the United States, should we Americans lose the great grim contest with the Soviet power, more formidable than ever the Jacobin power was? Or should we undo our Constitution ourselves on plausible grounds, substituting for it some frame of government purportedly suited to the age of the computer. Why, before long, we would discover, I think, that a nation's passage from a venerable old order to a hard, glittering new order would cannot be painless. For as Burke wrote of the British Constitution in 1791, he said in his words, "It is no simple, no superficial thing, nor to be estimated by superficial understandings. An ignorant man who is not fool enough to meddle with his clock is, however, sufficiently competent to think he can safely take to pieces and put together at his pleasure a moral machine of another guise, importance, and complexity, composed of far other wheels and springs and balances and counteracting and cooperating powers. Men little think how immorally they act and rashly meddling with what they do not understand." Well, America has made no great advances in Constitution decreeing since 1787. We've learned how to transplant human hearts after a fashion, precariously. But constitutions, the hearts of nations, remain unresponsive to sudden surgery. Burke, Hume, and Blackstone knew that, and their wisdom as political philosophers helped to prevent any advocacy at Philadelphia of such fantastic political illusions as took on flesh temporarily in Paris a very few years later. Well, so much for my very general history remarks on this topic of the theoretical basis of the Constitution.
We're pleased that Mrs. Kirk is with us today. If she or others want to open the discussion with questions, we'd be pleased to have that.
And that always has embarrassing questions. sorry to hear those.
He's asking the questions he doesn't want to answer. Makes interesting debate.
Okay. Henry Thielbach?
Do you find the interpretation and changes in the use and body of the Constitution made over the years primarily through legal interpretation consistent with or offensive to the basic concept that you outlined?
I think the tendency in general of the court has, Marshall onward, has been to enlarge upon the powers of the court itself and to allow the court a large discretion of interpretation. That, however, will be much more marked in the very recent years than ever it was before. That was expected of the framers. I knew that you cannot, there's a way of binding posterity. And indeed, when the Virginia Constitution Convention of 1829-30 meant, it was proposed to incorporate, as they did incorporate, an article for amendment and revision. And John Randolph opposed that entirely. So there should be no provision for revision. That's too tempting. Can't mind posterity anyway, just set it down as it is and don't provide, because posterity will change it anyway as they want to, and we'll just encourage them. So I think there has been widespread change in recent years, largely by court interpretation, which could very much have astounded the framers, and not constant in spirit, and changes are, well, they're being considered by the Supreme Court tomorrow, which would vastly enlarge public and federal control over private property and private life, which would have been astounding to the framers. The court has yet to decide it. It's an important case at issue right now.
Next question. Yes. Wilfred Brenfrom.
In England, Oxford, the exam, I was there as an undergraduate. I always did a lot of the constitutional history. And one of the things that you're excellent speech and books have brought back to me is I was brought up on the theory that the American Constitution, my special subject was the American Revolution and the formation of the Federal Constitution. And the general thing behind it was that the the American Constitution was founded on a complete misunderstanding of what the British Constitution was about. In other words, they were copying the situation as it was before the Glorious Revolution of 1689, but I'll only cite two things that I remember about these endless discussions. One was, I believe the king still has the power of veto, legally can do so, but he hasn't vetoed a bill since 1707. Also, the prime minister's office, as I understand it, till 1908 or something, didn't exist in law. And the idea of this was that the checks and balances theory could apply to the English government of 1689, but with all these what were called conventions of the Constitution that came in afterwards, that the Prime Minister is simply a party chief, and the King can throw out his advice, but if he throws it out, he's in trouble. What do you think of that idea?
Yes, that's certainly a sound interpretation. That is, the framers perhaps took somewhat too literally Montesquieu's understanding of the Constitution, which is partly out of date by the time of the Federal Convention, and partly perhaps Montesquieu didn't understand things perfectly. So they took a little too literally Montesquieu in their understanding of what the British Constitution was. But more important, I think, was the fact that the Constitution was in rapid process of change in Britain at the very time of the Constitutional Convention. As I mentioned, the no cabinet system was incorporated, obviously, into the federal constitution. They thought they'd get along without it. But at that very time, and particularly under the influence of Burke and the Rockingham Whigs, the cabinet system was being established. The Americans thought of the Constitution of Britain as had it existed, say, between the years 1760, say, and 1787. Already considerable change was occurring, and much more occurred during the last years of the 18th century, the first decade of the 19th. What happened was, of course, the triumph of the cabinet system that Burke recommended, and also the formation of responsible political parties of a permanent character, who would sought not primarily for preferment, but for the attainment of certain principles they were working for. The formation of the well-organized Whig and Tory parties at the beginning of the, after the French Revolution, chiefly early years of the 19th century. Burke was the chief mover in that, and therefore they couldn't be aware of what would happen in the next few years, the framers, but they necessarily tended to model their constitution upon what had been the British Constitution. One thing that Sir Henry Maine points out is that the powers given to the American presidents are precisely those enjoyed by George III at the time. And they didn't dare say so, of course, it's a very popular thing to say. That's what the prince powers were. It's a model for what a chief magistrate, let us say, should enjoy. Now, those powers were being diminished at the very time they adopted the Constitution. George III was defeated in the Revolution by the things. His powers were being diminished, despite his control of the House of Lords, the appointment of new lords. And with the death of George III, things gave way, as it did in his time, and there was established, the supremacy of the House of Commons. The king still having residuary powers, which can be employed, have been employed in a secretive sense in recent years. Nevertheless, they thought the president had the powers of George III, those they established. And the president still has those powers. Our president has the powers of George III. He's much more powerful than the present king of England or the present prime minister. We have still an 18th century constitution which has changed far less during the 19th and 20th centuries than the British constitution has changed.
Next question. You'll have your day, but we'll let you slip in, Professor Morgan.
To follow up this whole matter with reference to Blackstone's influence on the framers of the Constitution, the fourth book of the Commentaries He explained the harmonious relations between the king's ministers and majorities in the House of Commons and back in Parliament by saying that the gentle suasion of corruption has replaced the stern prerogative. Could that have been known to the American framers, and could they have been influenced by that understanding? In other words, could their knowledge of the British Constitution have been very much up to date when they framed the American Constitution?
In that respect, they're certainly influenced, depicted, of course, by Burke's speeches on corruption with the king's friends and the government. And the corruption meant primarily the power to influence the House of Commons and to dominate the House of Lords by employing the patronage powers of the throne, of the crown. That he did, of course, by packing the House, George III did, by packing the House of Lords, and by offering preferment of one kind or another, patronage to members of the House of Commons. And Burke fought that throughout the Whigs. And Burke's so-called Economical Act, which is the first British Civil Service Act, so to speak, was a vast passed and was a powerful means of checking what Burke had called corruption. From his thoughts in the present discontents on down to late in his career, some means of checking corruption, taking patronage out of the hands of the king, and regularizing political appointments, what we call civil service appointments. And yes, the Americans were well aware of that feature of development, and were afraid, of course, of the powers of corruption in America. And that's one reason why their great emphasis upon checks and balances. Madison and others maintaining that the mutual jealousy of different officers of government, different departments, will check corruption, and one will watch the other, and thus diminish the powers of corruption that lie in the hands of appointments.
Yes.
What did the framers take from England or from other sources in their creation of the Supreme Court?
There they had no very good precedent. Montesquieu was always emphasizing the independent judiciary of Britain. And it's true it is independent in the sense that it's supposed to be removed from politics, and by and large there are good appointments made, and there's no interference to the government in the decisions of courts. Nevertheless, obviously, there is no Supreme Court in Britain in the American sense, nor was it so independent as perhaps as Montesquieu thought it was. After all, no court in England can contravene statutes of the House of Commons. Its power, I forgot what the court was, one of the superior courts in Britain, declined to enforce an act of the House of Commons. Certain enthusiasts in the United States, when the Supreme Court said, it's wonderful, the British now, their eyes have been opened, and they're declaring, the British courts are declaring unconstitutional acts of Parliament. All the court said to them in England was, we can't understand the language of the statute. We don't know what it means, or we don't know what the intent of Commons was. Therefore, we can't enforce it until Commons expresses more clearly their meaning. We'd like to enforce it, we just don't know what the meaning is. Won't you let us know? That's as far as they ever went in so-called declaring anything unconstitutional. The Americans followed Montesquieu rather than a British model. But again, is it unclear, of course, I suppose, to most people who were ratifying conventions in the several states. It's unclear even to them what the powers of the Supreme Court really were. Both Hamilton and Madison went about, both wrote in the Federalist, and went about speeches assuring people that would know the federal judicial branch would never think of interfering with the powers of the executive or with the legislative powers. They had no force behind them. It would be absurd to think that ever the courts would presume to any way impinge upon the powers of the Congress. If you will read Hamilton on that, you'll find he's probably being a little disingenuous. He wants the court to have large powers, but he keeps telling the public, no, it won't have any such powers. And Madison is, to some extent, too, probably disingenuous. They wanted the courts to have great power, but they didn't dare admit that to the public. So that probably the majority of the, so far as you can tell, the large number that the people who ratified the state ratified conventions didn't expect a judiciary any more independent than that of Britain. What they got was something different, in large part because the Federalists wanted something different from Britain.
Other questions? Yes, Christopher Fry.
I would like to ask you a question about the notion of mixed constitution, a notion that recently, or in the age of democracy, got somewhat lost, but recently in European political theory goes through kind of a renaissance. Throughout many centuries, it was a commonplace in political theory that the best possible constitution was a mixture between monarchy and oligarchy and democracy. And starting with Aristotle, Cicero, Thomas Aquinas, and later in Montesquieu, Boulamaki, all these people were writing on the notion of mixed constitution, reaffirming that it was the best solution. Now, my question, did the framers of the American Constitution know about the notion of mixed constitution? Does it appear in the Federalist Papers? Does it appear in the debates?
Yes, it certainly does. Very frequently in their lips, the idea of mixed constitution, which they, practically all the members of the Constitutional Convention had knowledge of the Greek and Roman constitutions, whether reading the original sources or reading the translation about those constitutions. And the praise of the mixed constitution by Polybius in particular was known to the framers and cited not the debates, but elsewhere by various of the framers of the Constitution. And they did another Aristotle. They weren't, however, slaves to classical thought. But one thinks of the remark of John Adams that he learned from Plato only two things, that husbandmen, that is, farmers, should not be excused from military service, and that the cure for sneezing is hiccups. That wasn't Plato and nothing else. But they didn't know about theories, Aristotelian and Ciceronian and Polybian, of mixed governments and approved them. And of course, the most voluminous writer of constitutions, most learned, even though he wasn't at the convention, being in London at the time, is John Adams, his defense of the constitutions of government of the United States, great, huge volume. And he deals at great length with mixed governments and says that's what American constitutions are like, referring at the time to the state constitutions and the Articles of Confederation and the forthcoming federal constitution being drawn up almost as he was writing. He says, yes, our governments are those, are mixed governments, the old understanding of that term. And therefore, he wanted a powerful executive, which they got, of course, models secretly upon George III's role in government. Powerful executive, that's one element of the Constitution. And then aristocracy, or kind of aristocracy, represented by the Senate of the United States, which, of course, members chosen by the state legislatures, presumably from men, distinguished citizens of the state of the legislatures we delighted to honor and to elevate to represent their states. This is an aristocracy, and he realized ordinarily these would be persons of considerable means. But he was, Adams since I had a good deal to say about democracy, or the aristocracy, and explaining what it is, he said any man is an aristocrat who can command two votes, his own and somebody else's. Says, anyone who have any following, you're an aristocrat. But he said he feared aristocracy. He's often misrepresented that point. He feared aristocracy, the domination of the rich and well-born, and therefore reemphasizes the need for a democratic element, which is that of the frequently elected members of the House of Representatives, more popularly elected. And he goes on to draw parallels in the various state constitutions and explain how these elements are found in many of the constitutions, particularly in his own Constitution of Massachusetts, from in the framing of which he had a considerable hand. He approached ordinarily a certain other constitution to some degree, notably that of Pennsylvania. But yes, Adams and many others deliberately praise mixed government, of which, as you say, sir, we've increasingly lost knowledge in America, the old classical idea of mixed government, more and more move toward in actuality, a plebiscitarian democracy, that is, the election of the president, all things being depending upon his personality. And beyond that, theoretically, more and more toward an unchecked mass democratic system, of a character which would have astounded the framers and would have been impossible in their age anyway, because of the lack of means of communication there, of ascertaining public opinion. But we're now moving toward a mass democracy, and when one sees various provisions for the revision of the Constitution, they're usually, even by people who think of themselves as conservative, these proposals are usually more than in the interest of, more in the direction of a mass democracy with the monarchical and aristocratic elements quite forgotten in the new proposals.
Other questions? Victor Yonke?
Not to Burke, in some historical viewpoints, Burke was primarily the defender of Western Christendom and the established way of doing things. The rising middle class that was taking place in England at that time would have been a threat to Burke's order of things. And he even attributed the classification that they were Jacobins in England, using them in the same categories in France. Actually, he was an agent for the Rockingham Group, and I think that he possibly would not foresee the changes. He opposed a lot of the changes that were taking place in Great Britain at that time. Do you have any comment on that aspect of Burke?
Yes, he certainly opposed Fox and the Whig radicals, and of course very important people like the Duke of Bedford and others, who were in their so-called constitutional plans. They wished to revise the Constitution. They argued they were restoring the Constitution, and they wished to bring, of course, in a large major democracy. And then he opposed, again believing in a mixed government, not in a democracy, although he was willing to extend the franchise so long as there was evidence there was a really popular demand for it, which demand he could not see within his own time, although it arose shortly after his death or in his late years. But it's true that Burke, like any statesman, necessarily cannot be sure of the future. He was generally pretty gloomy about what would happen. He expected the Jacobins to triumph. He always said it's better to die with a sword in hand than to yield. Still, he thought that Britain was going to lose, and indeed the old order in Europe generally was going to lose. And so he had himself buried secretly somewhere in the church or in the graveyard at Beaconsfield, but nobody knows now where he's buried, because he thought the Jacobins was going to win and expose his head and quarters on Temple Bar or some other place in London. As a matter of fact, Burke himself prevented the catastrophic change which he foresaw. As Woodrow Wilson wrote once, Burke had so important a part in all these great things that when we say Burke and the French Revolution, we're speaking of equal powers. Burke himself turned back the revolution by his eloquence and arguments, particularly his, and also his political astuteness. And thus, if you read his reflections on the revolution in France, you'll find it's hard for most people to read today. Of course, our standards of literacy have gone downhill, but it's hard reading for most students. And in his own day, had a limited readership. Tom Paine wrote a very successful popular rhetoric intended for anybody who could read at all. Burke was very different. And the sales of Paine's books were far greater, several times greater than Burke's books. And yet Burke won. Paine was rejected in Britain and America. And Burke was fine. Why so? Because Burke had the astuteness to write for the people who've influenced public opinion, holders of public opinion. And who were they in his day? One of our people who are in government, including the king himself, who was a good admirer of the reflections of the revolution in France, and he influenced Pitt very strongly, and many others. But he wasn't primarily aiming at just those who are in political office, aiming primarily at clergymen. Burke had estimated that when the revolution broke out in France, that two-thirds of the English clergy were in favor of the revolution. And these are the people whom he wrote. In short, these are the people who form public opinion, just as newspaper columnists and commonly television commentators do today. In those days, it was the English clergy. Political sermons were delivered from all the pulpits, political notices posted on the church boards outside the church and so on. Everyone went to church, practically everybody, and it was the clergy of the Church of England and the growing influence of the Methodist preachers that formed public opinion. And in Scotland, of course, that of the ministers. So to them he appealed in the fractions of the revolution in France, and I think I'm only two or three people ever pointed this out. It's written for the clergy. Has a heavily Latin vocabulary. The clergy understood Latin. There are many Latin words and phrases, which they, or lawyers, would understand, or the general public might be pretty vague about what these phrases meant. Moreover, there are numerous theological and religious references, a reference to religious authority, to the Christian understanding of man, human nature. And the clergy read these, and they were convinced. They were moved, too, obviously, by the violence and terror of the French Revolution, but here's a reasoned argument, which appeals to the clergy particularly, and the tone of their sermons began to change, and the tone of public opinion accordingly to change. One wouldn't appeal to the same group now with equal success. Those are the molders of opinion of the 18th century. Thus, Burke had a considerable foresight and a great success greater than he expected, even though he, like everyone else, could have very little glimpse into what would result in Britain, say, by the year 1832. He would no doubt have opposed the Reform Bill of 1832 had it been opposed in his time. Nevertheless, he might have approved it, because there seemed to be a public demand for it in 1832, had he still been there. I think there of an interesting exchange between my old friend T.S. Eliot, whose centenary this year is, and Robert Hutchins at the University of Chicago. You may recall that Eliot gave a series of formal lectures on education at Chicago, and which was later published in one of his books. And his nominal host was Robert Hutchins. And after Eliot's book came out, Hutchins wrote a rejoinder to it in the magazine Measure, in which he said that he denounced Eliot's views of education, and said, "The only difference between Edmund Burke and T.S. Eliot is that Eliot is a Democrat and Burke was not." Well, Eliot and I discussed this once at lunch in the Garrick Club, and he said, "When I returned to Chicago a year later, I found myself at a cocktail party with Robert Hutchins. So I went up to him and said, 'Mr. Hutchins, I'm very grateful for your comments on my book. You read it thoroughly, obviously, and while we disagree on some things, certainly your comments are very valuable to me and to others. But I wanted to ask you one question. Why did you say that the only difference between Eliot and Burke is that Eliot is a Democrat and Burke was not?' I said, 'Now, as for myself, I never called myself a Democrat. So far as I know, no one but you has ever called me one. And for my own age, I suppose I'm rather conspicuously anti-democratic.' Our own times considered, while Burke, for his time, was more or less democratic. He was called a leader of the Democratic faction. So why should you draw that distinction? It seems to me that things are the other way around." And so Mr. Hutchins turned his heel and walked away. I said, "Why do you do that, Russell?" And I, well, it's obvious he never read Burke. Do you always denounce him without having read it? And assuming that somehow the phrases that Burke used, the attitudes he took in 1780, would be exactly what Burke would say today, if you could imagine something transplanted to a different age. All these things have to be studied in the background of their own time, and language understood in the background of the way language understood then as it understood now. Yep.
The way the House of Commons in the English government has grown over the years, and the way our House of Representatives offers so little leadership in this country. Is there anything you can tell us?
Yes, that certainly is true. the growth of the authority and power of the House of Commons and the rather lower pews in which our House of Representatives tends to stand nowadays. Though the certainly the power of the House of Commons has grown, because there's no check upon it anymore. The idea of mixed government has been pretty well lost there, and really what the, whatever the House of Commons wants to do becomes the Constitution. Power and part of Burke and his friends led to that, although they didn't intend such a complete dominance for the House of Commons. But sure, the House of Commons was a lot more powerful than Burke and his friends ever expected it to be or wanted it to be. The battle was over won, so to speak. Still, the I must not say that the House of Commons is itself a very distinguished body nowadays. The House of Lords still is, both the with the hereditary peers and the light peers. So if you go to listen to any debates, this is the finest debating society in the world. It doesn't have much power anymore, but it's wise and literate men discussing things in the House of Lords and providing a slight check upon the impetuosity of the House of Commons. But the House of Commons, like the like our House of Representatives or like our state legislatures, is not in general a body of distinguished men. As late as 1832 and probably a good deal later, the vast majority of the members of the House of Commons were landed gentry, just landed proprietors. And they still held about 97%. And they still held a great large majority down really until almost the First World War in the land of proprietors. Now, if you look today at the roles of the House of Commons, each member has to put down what his occupation is, and the large majority are party agents. They're hired by the party, paid salaries as party agents, and they also are elected to the House of Commons. So the class has diminished in repute and intelligence there, as it has here, probably for somewhat similar reasons. But while there are checks upon the Commons, upon the representatives, House representatives, there are none really in effect upon the House of Commons, which means that it speaks with great authority and knows that what it says will happen. The House of Representatives is humbled somewhat by the counterbalancing power of the Senate and the presidential veto and the Supreme Court. The House of Commons doesn't need to worry about such things. Although there is a countervailing power of sorts, which could be invoked in emergency, which almost nobody in America is aware of. I was living in Britain at the time this power was last invoked, or almost invoked. It occurred during the last weeks of the Attlee government. The Labour government had been losing by-elections, so they'd gotten down to an overall majority on key votes in the House of Commons of only one or two seats, if that close. And it was clear that they would be defeated if a general election were held at that time. And in fact, on two or three votes, they were defeated, but these were not considered important enough measures to require the resignation of the government. Solely, of course, there came a public demand in the press and elsewhere for a general election. Obviously, the conservatives being very vocal in demanding this. But Attlee refused to resign, saying, well, we're going to stay on here, we're entitled to do so, at least until 7 years are up. At any rate, we expect to regain popularity, and what's more, we're going to go on through with our major things we proposed. Apparently, the conservatives might have said, well, as long as you don't change anything more, we'll let you wait until we prescribed term. But Attlee said, we're going to go ahead with nationalization of the land and other forms of nationalization not yet attempted. And the the majority of one, you're going to nationalize all the land? Yes, we're going to do that. That was, of course, highly unpopular with the large elements of the population and with the press. And they began to appear in the weekly magazine, The Spectator, letters or order notices, letters to the editor recommending the government resign. But more important, there was a regular column, which is like a court calendar, which then ran every week in the Spectator, the publication of great repute, although limited circulation. And the this court calendar began to obtain little notices of this sort. The king is said to be distressed at Mr. Attlee's failure to consult with him as to the possibility of a by-election. Just that one sentence appeared. Nothing happened. Mr. Attlee didn't resign. The next sentence, the next week, there appeared this sentence. Reliable sources report from the court that the king is distressed at Mr. Attlee's failure to confer with him and to set a date for a general election. He's unable to understand why Mr. Attlee has not kissed hands. Nothing Mr. Attlee continued to proclaim. He's going to continue to hold office. There came a third notice. Reported the king has consulted with various persons on whose advice he relies, upon those who understand best the British Constitution, and it was reported that the king feels that Mr. Attlee should resign. The general election can be held. Mr. Attlee did nothing. And this is the fourth week. Very forthright, short paragraph says the king is very surprised indeed that Mr. Attlee has not come to him and offered his resignation. And in case Mr. Attlee does not offer his resignation, whom will the army obey? Mr. Attlee resigned next day. In short, the emperor in Japan retains authority, so there's a residual authority in the hands of the monarchy still. When it comes to a constitutional crisis, there is that check that the king could intervene, and he still would have the obedience, not only of the majority of British subjects, but of the army. And so there is still some surviving check, although no one mentions it in public. The king can then, say, arrest the prime minister.
Russell Kirk, you'll be lecturing this evening on subjects of current interest, I gather, and historic interest. And this afternoon, the Jefferson Society is giving a reception honoring you. One of the questions I'm sure that sooner or later will come up, which you may wish to reserve for these later meetings, is the question, who are the true heirs of Burke? Are they the followers of Russell Kirk? Are they the neoconservatives, the cultural conservatives, the libertarians, the popular conservatives, the religious fundamentalists? Who are the real carriers of the tradition of Edmund Burke? Well, if you cared, or if you want to let people know, they can hear more later, whichever you prefer.
Now, briefly, the influence of Burke has always been strong, in, especially in legal quarters, in political philosophy. And direct knowledge of some of Burke remained strong until early in this century. That is, I still retain my mother's copy of his Speech and Conciliation, with her annotations in it. And when my mother was in school, practically every decent high school in America required study of the Speech and Conciliation. That was no longer required in the schools, perhaps a very few private schools somewhere may still use it, but otherwise not. Short, and Wilson loomed immensely important, Burke loomed immensely important for Woodrow Wilson, for William Howard Taft, for people of that generation. Was still a direct influence upon American public men. That obviously has diminished much since. Of course, we no longer have very many public men who are acquainted with political philosophy, practical politics, because they don't know the literary and philosophical sources. But the one practical politician of our time, so far as he is practical, a very wild, very popular one, very intelligent one, is Eugene McCarthy. And Eugene McCarthy says he obtains his first principle from study of Edmund Burke, and also study of the medieval schooling. But he said Burke is his guide in politics. Of course, his ideas are derived from. And this is undoubtedly true if you read through McCarthy's books. He also draws heavily from Tocqueville, but he says Burke is the dominant influence. And we'll find here and there a man of public affairs who others have known Burke. By and large, the knowledge of Burke is confined to a distinct minority that permeates the way through American politics. So his book had a strong influence, a very strong in with Marshall and with Justice Story, of the men of law and politics of that that generation. Nowadays, the influence of Burke upon conservative scholars in the academy remains large. There's not much direct influence upon people in public office, except so far as they get into second or third hand through my writings or writings of somebody else. The neoconservatives don't know much about Burke, by and large. They call themselves pragmatic. They're interested in what works. They have very little money of historical interests, and I think that a few have read Burke with any intention or understand him very well. And the so-called cultural conservatives or social conservatives, again, among them you'll find a number of people who take Burke seriously, but by and large, their sources, their knowledge are quite different. Many are, of course, are related to populism. I suppose the point of pain is more popular among them than many of them than that of Burke. So Burke exercises influence upon a small but active and imaginative minority. Not so much influence as once, I think, despite the fact that there has been a considerable revival interest in Burke beginning in the 50s and down to the present, that confined more to scholars than to practicing politicians.
I think what is most interesting about Russell Kirk's visit is that the impetus primarily for this full day comes from the students. Mr. Claude of the Jefferson Society, not our Claude in the government department, the group around the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is a national body, and a number of other student groups have taken the initiative in organizing this day. I think it's a tribute to you, sir, that at a center devoted exclusively to the study of the presidency, we have a number who turn to you for counsel and wisdom, even on a subject that at first glance seems removed from the presidency. And I hope the remainder of your day will be as rich and full of understanding for those who hear you as it has been for us this morning.